Good morning. Regardless of race, ethnicity, or religion. The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals handing down that decision yesterday. So roommates.com now can be brought to trial for possibly violating anti-discrimination laws because of the questions it asks about gender, sexual orientation, and whether someone has a child. I spoke a little bit earlier this morning with Michael Evans, who is co-counsel on the roommates.com case. He's representing the Fair Housing Councils of the San Fernando Valley and San Diego, which brought this case against roommates.com.
First thing is, if you're someone looking for a room to rent and you want to use the roommate website, you're required as a precondition to obtaining access to any housing information at all to disclose to the website personal information that is protected by federal and state law, such as your sexual orientation, your age, whether you have children, and your sex. And we felt strongly in the fair housing community that one should not be required to disclose one's protected statuses as a precondition to obtaining access to the housing market. And the court in this decision agreed with us that that there's no immunity under the Communications Decency Act for any of that conduct, for inquiring into home seekers' protected status and demanding that information as a condition to obtaining access to housing information.
Now, I thought that roommates.com claimed that it wasn't necessary for people to disclose that information, that they could just go past that drop-down menu and still link up with someone who needs a roommate or is seeking to rent a place.
No, in fact, if you read the decision, it's quite clear that these types of disclosures are mandatory. If you want any access to this, to the services at all, you absolutely must disclose your personal information, whether you're gay or straight, whether you have children, whether you're male or female, your age, and so forth. And these disclosures are mandatory, and if you don't answer those questions, you have no ability to access any housing information.
So at what point would it be okay for someone who's looking for a roommate to be able to get information on whether the person has children, whether they're a religious person or not, or of a particular faith? Or is that never legal to be part of the equation for someone finding a roommate?
Well, let me answer that question in two parts. First of all, the issues presented in this case apply to the housing market in general. So yes, the roommate market is certainly part of the housing market, and that was involved in this case, involved that issue. But the issues that we presented in this case are important because they apply equally to if you're trying to buy a home or rent an apartment or buy a condominium. And so the issues that are presented here are the same issues that would be presented in those markets. So the case wasn't about the particular context of roommate housing. The issues that were decided by the court had to do with the housing market in general.
But aren't they two different things? Isn't the housing market in general different than a roommate agreement? I mean, if I'm a landlord, I don't care if a Satanist rents from me, but I wouldn't want to share an apartment with a Satanist.
Yes, I'm contemplating the prospect of you living with a Satanist. But true enough. Let me just say this. The extent to which civil rights laws should apply to the rental of rooms, and let's be clear, the rental of rooms, these are landlord-tenant relationships where somebody owns housing and rents it out to someone as a tenant. And a landlord-tenant relationship is obviously a commercial relationship and one in which the law is a relationship which the law heavily regulates. So the extent to which civil rights laws apply to share housing is a question for the legislature, and the legislature has decided that with respect to the rental of rooms, sometimes you can discriminate and sometimes you can't. And that's been a legislative determination, and that was not an issue in this case. This case concerned the housing market in general and what types of practices are permitted, whether they take place in a traditional brick-and-mortar type of real estate agency or its online equivalent, which is what the website here is. It's a housing information broker, just like if you went to your local real estate agent. And we contended that a website can no more require you to disclose your sex or race or religion or sexual orientation as a condition to obtaining access to housing than your real estate agent can require you to disclose your sex or race or religion or sexual orientation as a condition to obtaining access to those services.
Are there brick-and-mortar places where they link together people who are looking to share an apartment or a house? And is it clearly established law that places that do that are not legally able to ask these kinds of questions about a person's identity or beliefs?
Well, the law is clearly established that those in the housing market do not have the right to demand disclosure of what we call protected status information, personal information about religion and sexual orientation, as a condition to obtaining access to housing market services. There's a separate question about the rental of rooms, and as I indicated, there are some exemptions in the law that are applicable to the rental of rooms. If you were if I had a room to rent in my house, and I wanted to ask you to rent the room, I could do that, and I would be exempt from the fair housing laws. But as a general matter, when you enter the marketplace for the rental of housing, and you advertise the rental of rooms in the commercial marketplace, you do have a duty not to discriminate as a general matter. But again, that's a legislative determination as to how broad or narrow the fair housing laws should be. And that's a determination that the state of California has made and that the Congress has made. And those issues were not presented in this particular appeal.
Michael Evans is co-counsel on the Roommates.com case. He represents those challenging Roommates.com policy of asking for this information. He was working on behalf of the Fair Housing Councils of the San Fernando Valley and San Diego. My question for you is, what do you think of this ruling by the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, which now sends to the trial court the question of whether Roommates.com engaged in discriminatory and illegal behavior? We're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. We're joined by Stanford Law School resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society, Chris Ritter. Thank you for being with us on Air Talk.
Thanks very much.
How significant is this ruling in treating a company that operates solely on the Internet like this and treating it the same way as if it had an actual physical location?
Well, I think it's a very significant ruling. It mostly applies to what happens on the Internet by interpreting Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. I'm not a fair housing expert. I'm more of an internet guy.
Right. But have internet entities generally been exempt from these kinds of federal laws?
Well, so this law makes service providers who simply provide a platform for users to communicate immune to certain laws. In fact, most of the defamation laws, that's kind of the context this originally arose in, and some others, the law says that the provider of the website or the online service won't be regarded as the publisher of the information.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason this was important was search engines like Google and forums where lots of people post make it virtually impossible for the website owner to comb through every post and identify which one may be legal or not legal. And, basically the internet couldn't happen, especially these, social-oriented sites, couldn't happen if the owners of the websites were constantly subject to liability. So that's the initial inspiration for this rule. There was a very similar case to this one that came down from the Seventh Circuit recently about Craigslist,
mm-hmm.
where people post about their preferences for roommates. And the Seventh Circuit said 230 provided immunity, but the difference between that case and the Roommate.com case here is that Roommate.com explicitly solicited the discriminatory preferences of its users.
It wasn't just open-ended,
exactly.
A place for people to write what they wanted to write in what they were seeking. There were drop-down menus where you click on what particular affiliation you have or characteristic you have that would be part of the process. Chief Justice of the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, Alex Kaczynski, who wrote for the majority, made just that distinction. He said, roommates.com designed its system to use allegedly unlawful criteria. And so that would be different than what Craigslist, Google, Yahoo, others supposedly do, where it's just left open-ended for people to communicate to with each other.
Right. Although Judge Kaczynski did talk about the drop-down menus, it's a little bit unclear what kind of drop-down menus you can have in light of this decision. It might be that a drop-down menu that neutrally lists all, you know, races and preferences might be okay, as long as the website isn't requiring you to fill it out in any particular way.
So you could have a list that would have, let's say, you know, 20 personal characteristics, and you could choose to click on any of those or nothing, and then move through the process of linking up with a roommate. That might be legally okay, as opposed to you have to choose male, female, Protestant, Catholic, Jew, whatever the criteria would be.
Well, you would have to be very careful. If the website owner were to say under this decision, select your racial preferences on using the following drop-down menu so that you can discriminate in housing,
yeah,
I think that would not be okay. If the website owner said, here's a drop-down list of many things for you to describe yourself.
Who you are, yes. That'd be different.
I mean, there's a line here that's not entirely clear, but that's where the line is.
We're speaking with legal scholar Chris Ritter. He joins us from Stanford University. We invite your calls at 866-893-KPCC. Chris Ritter is a resident fellow at the Stanford Law School Center for Internet and Society. 866-893-5722. Looking forward to your feedback on this ruling by the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio.
Programming is supported by The Daily News, offering fast, accurate, in-depth, and complete coverage of the local news and issues that affect your life the most. In print and online at dailynews.com. The Daily News, your hometown connection.
This is 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Hetty Lynn Hurdies. Comedian Chris Rock testified today that he hired private investigator Anthony Pelicano to find incriminating information on a Hungarian model who filed a paternity claim against him. The 64-year-old Pelicano, who's acting as his own attorney, is charged with running a criminal enterprise that illegally wiretapped the adversaries of his high-powered clients. Pelicano and his four co-defendants are collectively facing 107 charges. All five have pleaded not guilty. Funeral services are being held this morning at the Cathedral of Our Lady of the Angels for firefighter Brent Lovren. The 35-year-old Lovren was killed last week in an explosion near LAX as he investigated a blast that was strong enough to blow manhole covers into the air. There are several downtown street closures in effect this morning: Main between 1st and Aliso, Temple between Los Angeles and Grand, and northbound Grand between 1st and Temple. Hill Street is also closed between Ord and First. All the closures are expected to be lifted by 1 o'clock. It's 1021 at KPCC.
Do you have an old car, truck, or boat taking up space in your garage? Give it to KPCC. Donating your used vehicle goes a long way toward paying for the news and information you count on each day. It takes just a couple of minutes to schedule a pickup, and we'll send you a receipt for your income taxes. Find out more online at kpcc.org or call 877-KPCC-CAR. Thanks.
This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I'm just online at roommates.com and actually looking at the site here and how it's laid out. And if you are looking for a room to rent, how the system operates, what people tell you about themselves, this following yesterday's ruling issued by the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, Chief Judge of that panel, Alex Kaczynski, wrote the opinion for the majority in which he said, yes, there is a legal claim that can potentially be made against roommates.com. Now goes to the trial courts to decide whether roommates.com engaged in discriminatory practices in offering limited drop-down menus where people using the site choose to either say characteristics about what they're seeking in someone who would be renting a room from them or in what they are disclosing about themselves. We're at 866-893-KPCC. Let's talk with Edward in Compton. You're on Air Talk.
Hi, Larry.
Hi, Edward.
I think that the Ninth Circuit got this one wrong. The way I've always seen it, used roommates.com before, is that it's more of a social networking site, and from that network, you get to choose a roommate that you're comfortable with.
Yeah, and
I wish they hadn't done this.
Well, and the point I was trying to make in asking the question of the attorney who was representing the Fair Housing Organizations is there not a distinction between if you're renting a house or an apartment that you own but you don't live there versus you're taking someone into your home or you yourself are looking at renting a room in someone's apartment or home? It's a fundamentally different relationship, isn't it, than if you're not living in the unit that you're renting?
I agree. If someone has different religions, can cause uncomfortableness with people living together. You said saintedness, for instance.
Yeah.
Admittedly, some people have problems with roommates, especially if people of the same-sex orientation in the same room.
All right. So, Edward, you think this is too far-reaching. You're disappointed in the decision. Chris Ritter of Stanford University, you want to respond?
So this decision didn't actually reach the question of whether it was in fact discriminatory. It simply held that roommates.com was not immune from the question being asked, and it's going to remand to the district court. And I think you've identified an important issue that certainly, there is some ability to discriminate when you are, you know, the person who lives in the house or wants to live in the house with another person. You have a right to choose who you want to live with. The question here is whether a housing broker can screen out the list of potential applicants. And I think that's a little bit of a different call. You know, whether you're, on Craigslist, you can look at the post and see what these people want of a roommate and make your own decision or talk to them or visit the place, and you can both decide whether you'd be good roommates. And that's fine, but what roommate was doing is actually, saying, make a list of your racial preferences and we will compare with other people's racial preferences. You won't see, the listings for things that are contrary to your preferences. And I think it's a much tougher call whether they can do that.
They're pre-selecting the categories of identity. And so in that you can make the point, well, they're serving as an editor in choosing these categories of race or ethnicity, of gender or religion, whatever it is. And it's the decisions that someone makes in taking someone into their home probably far more sophisticated and nuanced than those kinds of very broad strokes as to who an individual is. Let's take another listener call from Aaron in Glendale. You're on Air Talk.
Hi. Yeah, this is a question mostly for the professor, actually. I was wondering if I know in employment discrimination practices, there's a very specific distinction between the person providing, say, the employment opportunity and the employee themselves. Is there the same distinction being made here then between the service provider itself being discriminatory in its actions and individuals using the sites being discriminatory then?
Well, that's it's an interesting question. I'm not sure that there is a rule against being discriminatory when you're the, you know, the one seeking a roommate. So I'm not sure. I think there is a distinction between the people seeking roommates and the actual site, and I think the Craigslist case illustrates that quite well. That, you know, I'm not aware of any claims being brought against individual people who are looking for roommates, but the website itself, by facilitating the discussion, was not liable, you know, where roommates is, for actively developing information that seems to be, you know, making the entire marketplace for housing based on discriminatory criteria.
This whole area of shared housing is a fascinating one because it's not just a commercial relationship. It's a semi-social, or in some cases, full-on social as well as economic relationship. And I mean, sort of a fascinating area of law, and I'd love to follow up this conversation by getting into that issue of how it's differentiated under the law from a straight, you know, landlord, rentor kind of policy where you have a number of anti-discrimination laws in place to try and keep people from excluding individuals from having access to housing. Shane in Huntington Beach, welcome to Air Talk. Hi, Shane, you there? Apparently not. Okay, we'll talk with Tom in Laguna Hills. You're on Air Talk.
Larry, your points are salient. I think the most important question that's to be raised here is the responsibility of this lawsuit. If it's permissible to discriminate as getting a roommate, and I think this is the main distinction, this is not fair housing, this is roommates. You don't want an 18-year-old living with a 35-year-old man if he's the first guy to come to the door. If these are fair discriminatory practices, then the fact that the website utilizes them doesn't, it's being consistent. And if it didn't work, they wouldn't be doing it. So these are the categories people want. They're doing it because obviously a website like this is developed because they see what people want. They do market testing and they produce that. So these are the fields that people care most about when trying to select who they want to live with. I just think a lawsuit like this is reaching. It's excessive and it's unnecessary.
All right, thank you, Tom. We appreciate hearing your opinion. Chris Ritter of Stanford, final comment from you, sir.
I think. You know, the ruling doesn't reach the fair housing questions, although the court seems to think there might be a problem. But it's really about the extent to which website owners and online service providers should have immunity from these suits at all, so such that even if it was illegal, they could never be, held liable. And I think one thing that I'm going to be looking at as we go forward is what other contexts outside of housing might this be applied to. If you have a website that encourages people to defame others, you know, what level of encouragement is going to subject you to defamation liability?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think, looking at the contours, how broad this decision really is going to be important.
Yeah, well, it's certainly fascinating. We thank you, Chris Ritter, for being with us on Air Talk.
Sure, thanks.
Thanks. He's from Stanford Law School. He's a resident fellow there in Stanford Center for Internet and Society. We'll see what comes now from the trial court, given the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court's decision yesterday that there are issues to be tried regarding this challenge by fair housing organizations against roommates.com. This is Air Talk on KPCC.
A common misconception about public radio is that it's paid for with government money. In fact, government funding is only a small part of KPCC's total budget. Most of the money it takes to run KPCC comes from individual listeners who become contributing members. Every single member makes a difference. So, contribute today at kpcc.org. And thanks.
Big announcement yesterday by MySpace, where many recording artists and individual musicians choose to put information about where they're going to be performing and about their recordings. MySpace now banding together with all but one of the major record labels to be able to offer the music through MySpace. So it's another opportunity for the labels that have been hit so hard by declining CD sales to be able to offer the product of their musicians. Now, currently, of course, iTunes is the biggie in this field of downloadable music, but this gives yet another place for signed artists to be able to offer their music. To talk with us about the significance of this decision and the agreement that's been reached is Don Chmielewski of the Los Angeles Times. Thanks, Don, for being with us.
Thank you, Larry.
Well, how long have these talks, to your knowledge, been going on? Has there been a lot of courting between MySpace and these record labels?
There has. As far as I understand from my conversation with the labels, the discussions began 3 or 4 months ago. MySpace actually initiated the talks. And here, this is the nature of how the discussions went. MySpace has an enormous community of people who are built around their affinity for music. Roughly 30 million people use MySpace Music on a regular basis to watch music videos, etc. So MySpace's idea is to find a way to capitalize on an audience that already has a passionate affinity for music.
And are there any ways now for artists on MySpace? I'm sure the overwhelming majority of musicians are unsigned who are on MySpace currently. Is there any way for them to make their music available to fans via MySpace now?
Sure. I mean, right now, bands and many already do make their music available in streaming form. Some provide tracks directly. A lot of the 5 million artists who use MySpace are, as you mentioned, unsigned, but this is a way to expand that relationship between the musician and the fan by offering a variety of things, from downloadable ringtones to concert tickets to T-shirts.
And will this help unsigned artists as well? Will they have access to the same sort of direct sales potential of music as signed artists will through these record labels in MySpace?
Well, I don't know all of the deal terms yet. In fact, none of the parties really has disclosed even pricing, for instance. But this is, bands have long used MySpace as a way to create that sort of intimate relationship with the fans, and of course, get emails so that they can alert fans when they're traveling through a city to tour. But one could imagine that this presents an opportunity to expand to try to grow some of that revenue that's been lost since 1999 because of dropping CD sales.
Now, EMI, the British-based label, has chosen not to take part, at least yet. What do you know about why they're not part of the deal?
They're still in discussions.
Okay. And are as you understand it, are each of the labels negotiating similar terms or the same terms for the economic partnership with MySpace?
Yeah, with the no one is, of course, volunteering deal terms at this juncture. What I do know is this. Both MySpace and the labels recognize that there is a large and growing pot of advertising revenue. eMarketer estimates something like $30 billion will be spent in online advertising. And clearly both the labels and MySpace would like a growing share of that.
And what is the model here? Is it that streaming would be free but advertisers subsidized, but downloads a user would have to pay, or what have they released any of that?
That is exactly right. So it's the idea is to capture some new revenue through advertising, so ads would pay for free music streams and for free music videos. But there would also be a download component. So for people who want to make CD mixes of their favorite music, they can purchase a download. Or for those who want to transfer to a portable device, at least some of those downloads are going to be made available without the kinds of software locks that prevent us from buying music from a store other than iTunes and putting it on our iPod.
And is it the same compression format as iTunes used? So this would be in an MP3 and with the downside that MP3 has? Or would they be looking at other forms of compression?
Again, lots of those details not available. Even Apple doesn't use MP3. It uses a slightly different format, AAC, which it claims has higher fidelity. I frankly am so old I can't hear the difference anymore. but be assured that you will be hearing the music has to be compressed just for ease of download purposes.
All right. Don Chmielewski, thank you very much for joining us from the Los Angeles Times and talking about the deal with all but one of the major record labels. And we'll see if this is, in fact, a strong competitor to iTunes and its success.
Thank you very much, Larry.
Thanks. Thanks very much. With us in studio is Eric Garland, the CEO of Big Champagne, a market data research company that looks at Internet music behavior. Eric, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
How big a deal is this in your view?
It's a big deal for the big business of music. I was thinking about this while Don was talking. You know, your listeners who may be musicians, who may make their living in music, they have probably been availing themselves of MySpace as a tool to promote and even sell their music for a long time. So MySpace and music have always been in large part synonymous. That part of this announcement is not new. What's new is that the largest music companies, what we tend to call the big four, recorded music companies, have struck deals, or three of them have now announced deals. One of them is still working on a deal to make their music available for sale at MySpace. Now, even their music has been available to listen to and to stream all along at MySpace. But now they're building in additional capabilities that will drive revenue. So for an independent artist or an unaffiliated artist, MySpace has always really been a good opportunity, a good tool set. It gets a little bit better because they're integrating new functionality, additional features for those musicians. But I think the real news here is about the big business of music and those companies trying to taste, as Don alluded, this great pool of advertising and other revenue.
But for unsigned artists, at this point on MySpace, correct me if I'm wrong, they still need to have a link to their own personal website where there's information on, and they have to have a PayPal deal or what, however it is that they sell their CDs typically from their website, right?
Yeah, I mean, there are some third-party tools that allow independent artists and have allowed them to sell their music on their MySpace page. But the point you're making is the right one. It takes a little industry. It takes a little additional work on the part of the artist who probably wants to focus on writing songs and playing music. They've had to go out and pull together third-party tools and do a little work to get music available for sale onto their MySpace page. And presumably now, a lot of that extra effort is going to be eliminated.
We're speaking with Eric Garland, CEO of Big Champagne, a market data research company that looks at internet music behavior. The deal announced yesterday between three of the four major record labels and MySpace, so that MySpace Music will be featuring direct opportunities to purchase downloads of the music of the signed artists who are on those major labels, and potentially also offering independent musicians, I like that term, independent musicians a chance to be able to directly sell their product as well.
California Report stories on 89.3 KPCC are made possible by the Evelyn and Walter Haas Jr. Fund, the AARP and its 3 million California members working to ensure access to affordable quality health care for all Californians, online at aarp.org, and by OSH, Complete Home and Garden Service to Californians for over 75 years. Ideas, tips, and solutions at osh.com. Well, get ready to win some tickets to a movie screening. We're giving away two tickets to Young at Heart at the ArcLight on Sunset Tuesday, April 8th at 7:30. This comedic documentary is about a lively chorus of seniors who prove that rock and roll will never die. Young at Heart opens in select theaters April 9th. For more info, visit arclightcinemas.com, and we'll take the third caller at 626-585-7893. Four prison guards were hurt yesterday in an attack at a maximum security facility in California. KPCC's Steve Julian says prisons throughout California went on immediate lockdown.
Officials with the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation say two inmates at a prison south of Bakersfield stabbed three male guards with homemade weapons. Each guard was sent to the hospital with puncture wounds and cuts. A female guard was also hurt. The attack ended when other officers used pepper spray and batons on the suspects, who are said to be members of a Southern California Mexican gang. The two are serving time for murder and attempted murder. The Tehachapi prison was built in 1933 to hold about 2,800 female inmates, but today it houses nearly 5,000 men. The last California prison guard to die in the line of duty was 3 years ago in Chino. That guard also was stabbed. Steve Julian, 89.3, KPCC.
Taking a look at traffic in Sherman Oaks, the 101 South is slow right now from Van Nuys Boulevard to Woodman, then again from Vine to the 110. It's 10:41 at KPCC.
This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Three of the four major record companies have announced a deal with MySpace so that MySpace Music will now offer opportunities for free streaming and paid downloading of music from those artists. This gives the labels an opportunity to try and make up some of the slack from declining CD sales. And we're talking with the CEO of Big Champagne, which does research into how people use music online, Eric Garland. Eric, I want to ask you about the profit potential here. I mean, declining CD sales have hit these companies very, very hard. There's so much uncertainty in the music business now. Do you think potentially they can make enough money online to either do as well as they used to do or maybe even better at some point?
They can certainly make enough money online to ultimately grow the business. I think the tricky part is that it's becoming clear that they cannot make enough money through the sales of individual songs online to bridge that gap. In other words, people spent so much money to acquire really an individual song. There was no opportunity for the last 20 years to buy singles in the bricks and mortar world. And
right.
So when people heard a song they liked, they really had to make a financial commitment of $15 or $16 or even $18 to own that song. In the age of iTunes, it's been clear that the appetite for music online has increased, but it hasn't increased by 15 or 16 or 18 times. And so when the price of music is a dollar a song now, it's impossible for these companies to make up the gap. I think what experiments like MySpace Music will demonstrate is that music companies are now looking beyond the sale of a 99-cent song to try to make money online. And I agree with them, broadly speaking. That's where the opportunity lies.
So funny, we've gone back to the past where the song is really the key. I mean, I'm thinking of days of sheet music and singles after that and 78s. Then we got into an era where music, in a sense, was taken more seriously, that the album was a conceptual album and it wasn't about the song so much. We saw the Beatles make this transition as a beautiful example.
Right.
From song makers to album conceptualizers. And now it's like we've gone back to the song being king.
That's right. And in fact, there are great albums being made today and people really enjoying and investing in those albums. When I say investing, I mean investing their time to really get to know that conceptual work. But the popular business of music is really driven by the song. The song is king, and that has had devastating economic impacts on the traditional business when the business moved online.
Now, for other than pop music, I'm wondering if your CD sales have still held up. Thinking of, you know, jazz and classical, for example, obviously they're a small share of the overall market and have been for many years since jazz was popular music many decades ago. But have they held their niche in the CD market?
It's interesting that you would ask that question today, because while it is true that classical music in particular has held up well on CD, one of the bellwethers, sort of the canary in this coal mine, has long been considered country music, because country music fans have traditionally been album buyers and they've traditionally been people who buy their music at traditional retail as opposed to online. Numbers released yesterday, point of sales data, suggest that not only has the country music category declined on a par with CD sales overall this year, and they're down more than 10% after being down almost 15% last year. So that decline is really rapid. Country music CDs as a category actually decreased a little more rapidly than the overall or the pop category. And so we have not really seen an erosion in classical nor jazz. But I think country makes clear that people are increasingly going to migrate online, and that ultimately the CD will be, you know, sort of like a comic book. It will be a product, but not a mass
but
product.
But a boutique product.
That's
definitely
right. Yeah.
Well, and in raising the point about country, that still is a song-based genre of music, right? I mean, it's radio making hits and building up artists and particular songs that are associated with them. So that would seem ripe for downloading and online usage versus CDs.
Well, it held up a little bit longer than rock and pop, but as of this year, it looks like it really is changing over.
And I would guess that's because of the adoption of the technology
exactly
among the demographic of country listeners more than anything else.
Seems to be the case.
All right. We'll continue with our guest, the CEO of Big Champagne, Eric Garland. And our phone line's open for you. I'd like to hear your thoughts, particularly from musicians. If you're a musician who uses MySpace Music, and it's been an important vehicle for you to build your fan base, stay in touch with fans, be able to talk about the kinds of things you're doing creatively as well as the business side of your music making, I'd like to hear what you think of this deal between three of the four major music labels and MySpace. 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. With us is independent musician and producer Rara Avis. Thank you, sir, for joining us on Air Talk.
You're welcome. It's good to be here.
I understand you're a multi-instrumentalist as well as a singer and that you produce music. How does this affect you, if at all?
Well, it doesn't really affect me that much. I've already, I'm definitely connected with the third-party idea. I've been able to sell music on MySpace through a site called Reverb Nation that allows me to post MP3s for sale on any social networking site and my own site. So it's not an something that's new to me, and it's really just kind of, like your previous guest said, based in a realm of the big business guys kind of trying to get in on some of this social networking money that's available through advertising and such.
So do you see this as making it more difficult for you as an independent artist to do your thing, the fact that signed musicians are going to be now included in this kind of direct effort to sell through MySpace, or do you just not see that as competitive with what you're doing?
Well, it remains to be seen a little bit, but ultimately I don't think it's going to impact myself. I think for independent artists, it more impacts the people that don't have the savvy to actually get online and get these tools working for them. And yet, again, I don't see it directly competing. I mean, big business in music has always had a really darker, ugly side that no independent musician likes. And, you know, there was sort of a breath of fresh air when the internet first started becoming a main tool for fans getting in touch with their musicians. I think there was a sense that somehow they'd pushed big business out of the way, and that was a good thing. But ultimately, you know, big business is going to spend all of its resources trying to figure out how to stay on top of the pile. And independent artists, as they've done for a while, are going to continue to, you know, kind of eke out their survival as best they can. And I think my experience is that MySpace in general and other social networking sites have given a chance for fans and musicians to get closer and more intimate, and that's really the biggest benefit. So ultimately, this deal really, I don't know that it's going to reflect too much. It may just make MySpace kind of more crowded and have a lot more large-scale marketing happening, which may tend to turn people away from searching for better independent music.
We're speaking with musician and producer Rara Avis. Quinn in West Hollywood, you're on Air Talk.
Hi, I'm just calling to talk about the MySpace thing. I think it's really good that the labels are finally catching on to this. However, I don't really think it's going to make that big of a difference. Like your guest just said, this is going to make MySpace really crowded. And I've been an independent musician for a few years now. I live in Los Angeles. I do music. And I just feel like MySpace is kind of like passé. Like a lot of people that are doing music now are kind of starting to look at MySpace as something that's old. And I think that what you're going to see in the next couple of years is just the labels are going to kind of fall out of it. You're going to be looking at musicians being able to put their music anywhere, people being able to find whatever music they want, and they're not going to have to rely on the labels to tell them what to like or to suggest what to like. They're just going to find whatever they want, wherever they want it, and it's going to spread out music a lot more, and I'll take my response off.
Well, let me just ask you, Quinn, do you think that there's any need for a gatekeeper, or in what form can that gatekeeper be? Because as this becomes more and more crowded with more and more artists out there, what are going to be the tools for people to actually find the musicians who they really dig? What, how do you link the consumer, the music lover up with the artist?
Well, I think that the internet is still going to play a role in that, and you're still going to see sites like MySpace doing those things. Facebook is a big one now. They've just, you know, got on the music train. They can do that now. I think that other musicians are going to play a role in this, and just like the social networking sites are going to play a role, but not like MySpace is. I think that social networking sites are going to like play a role in connecting people so that they can actually socially network with one another. And I think music has always been something that's grown like through people saying, hey, this band's cool, you like this, oh, you like this. So, you know, they're trading music that way. And I think the gatekeepers are really going to start to be people. And you're seeing this with the internet in all kinds of different media. Like television now is kind of fading as TV shows are put on the internet. I think this is going to be something that just continues. The gatekeepers are going to be the people who actually listen to the music and who buy the music, and they're going to tell each other what's cool.
Well, I guess we're seeing that even with YouTube and other sites like it, for example, where word of mouth is really the driver. There are no commercials for YouTube short videos elsewhere or billboards to tell you to go look at a particular video. And yet, hits are made, you know, on a regular basis on places like YouTube. I wonder if you want to comment on that issue and, you know, sort of gatekeeping, Eric, and the filtering process.
Yeah, I mean, Quinn, I think, raised one really interesting point, which I think is exactly right. And that's that there have always been tastemakers, and they tend to be early adopters in new technologies or in communities online. And so for a long time, MySpace was regarded as a place that the cool kids had adopted and taken for themselves. Now, there is this sense among a lot of the earliest users of MySpace that it's become the Mall of America. But I would point out that for major music companies who have always sold more music in the malls than they have in the smaller independent record stores, that's the time that's ripe. In other words, by the numbers, this really is the time for them to crowd in, as has been suggested, and perhaps mitigate the cool factor a little bit. But there are so many people now using these tools, not the early adopters, but those who came to it a little later, that it's probably a good place for them to be. There's a salve for all of those who don't welcome them, and that's that these social networks are continually evolving and changing, and people are always taking up residence in new ones. So I wouldn't be surprised if you saw a lot of independent artists and their fans finding new places to be and to socialize and discover music. MySpace is becoming much more mainstream than it was a couple of years ago.
Thanks, Quinn. Appreciate your call. Lori in Silver Lake, you're on Air Talk.
Hi, Larry.
Hi.
I've got a small label myself. My late husband was Art Pepper, and I...
Oh, wow, yeah.
And it's only possible now to do this. And while the record companies are wringing their hands about being unable to sell jazz or classical as they used to, and I heard somebody say that it hasn't affected it, but it really has. And they're all saying it can't be sold, because they weren't quick to take up this wonderful technology, which I am enjoying like crazy. It's the only way I could be selling these records.
Lori, thanks. So appreciate it. Eric?
Yeah, I mean, I think the point is not that classical and jazz will not migrate online. They will, absolutely. I think one of the things that those two particular types of music have going for them is that their fans still really do value the listening experience. And as you sort of alluded to earlier, Larry, the quality of the music that you can access online, generally speaking, not in every case, but generally speaking, is not really up to par for someone who really wants to listen to, let's say, a classical work in a listening room.
Well, that's why I don't have even an iPod, for example. I can't listen to music on an iPod. The compression bothers me. I feel it's not as bad as AM radio, but it just doesn't do it for me. I feel, who is it? Someone says, like, listening through a screen door.
Right.
For me, it doesn't work to listen to music. I need a CD to get that level of information coming through. Lori, with the music that you're selling, are you doing it with downloads, or how are you making the music available?
I am not discriminating. If somebody wants to hear this music as a download, and I am I am absolutely sure that downloaded music, that the quality of the compression is going to continue to improve.
Certainly.
Yeah, so I am selling it as CDs online through various vendors, and I'm selling it also through iTunes, and anywhere anybody wants to download it, they can buy it. And the whole point of this is that a niche market is what the Internet was created for.
That is beautifully said.
Yeah, I was just going to say my exact words. Beautifully said, Lori. Thank you very much. We appreciate your sharing with us your experience.
I think if major music companies had taken that approach, I mean, that philosophy that she just articulated so well really has been the difference between their relative failure to date and what would have been, I think, a real success story. They didn't adopt that attitude. Let's make the music available in as many forms as people want it and make it conspicuously available and make it easy for people to get what we have that they want. I just think that's the strategy that every independent should adopt. And ultimately, that's what the major music companies are going to have to do, too.
Johnny in Toluca Lake, you're on Air Talk.
Hey, Larry. How you doing?
It's going well.
Hey, you know, I've been listening to some of the people that talk about MySpace, and I've just listened to the last lady who mentioned jazz. I'm actually a jazz, sort of pop jazz singer like Michael Bublé.
Mm-hmm.
And MySpace has been amazing for me to be able to actually target Michael Bublé fans and Peter Cincotti fans and stuff like that. And I've actually been able to get my music out to,
well, that's great,
14, 15-year-olds, you know.
You're making the point I was asking earlier, you know, what is the filter? And so you're saying this is the way you can link up with people who already are into this genre.
Yes, yes. You can actually, like, I'll type in Michael Bublé and go, I'll be on a fan site that I'm actually maybe a member of. And there's, you know, people talk about it just being an old genre as far as jazz. MySpace has allowed you to go in and you see there's 16, 17, 18-year-old girls who are Michael Bublé fans who are getting that exposure. I've been able to actually really use that, and I've been able to get a lot of fans and sell music through MySpace because of that.
Johnny,
so
thanks.
I really do think that it's a great medium that is continuing to build. I don't think it's going away at all.
Johnny, thanks very much. Appreciate you sharing that experience. Eric, final word on this.
The great democratization of music has clearly occurred in these communities and online.
And as the technology improves and as this evolves, I mean, the thing we have to remember is this is still a new baby in many ways.
It is.
You know, we think about, well, the Internet's been around so many years now. It really hasn't compared to other technologies. And we're figuring out how to use it in ways that are the most effective. Eric, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry.
And our thanks to musician Rara Avis as well. Eric Garland, CEO of Big Champagne Market Data Research Company, looks at internet music behavior. Coming up next, Film Week on Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio.
Programming is supported by the law firm of Shepard Mullen. Attorneys in Shepard Mullen's downtown and Century City offices represent clients in industries ranging from aerospace to banking to entertainment. More information available online at shepardmullen.com.